They're bad. They're boys. And occasionally, they talk about running. Yes, it's the Bad Boy Running Podcast with your hosts, Jody Rainsford and David Heller. Come back. Baby, come back.
But bye, 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 bye. But bye, 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 bye. I must admit I was a clone to be messing around. But that doesn't mean that you have to leave town.
So, do better.
There's only one.
Do better.
We just will brilliant into one. The relationship has been depleting, but bloody hell, it's not that bad.
And this includes the editor.
When the guests and presenters are outnumbering the listenership, we are absolutely screwed.
Yeah, this is why we invited twins on a few weeks ago to double up. But do better. If you've not listened to the first episode with Robbie, go and listen, because we're going to pick up from where we left off. Maybe. I don't know.
What's but that? Robbie's written like a book. 300 episodes ago.
I haven't listened to it. I don't remember what I said in that one, let alone like I don't remember last week.
Actually, I think where we were, you'd moved to Chamonix to be focusing more on trail, and then you've been there a year and been like, it's going to take more than a year to become a trail. Shit, I hadn't realised. I thought one summer and I'd be the best. I think that's where we left you.
This is embarrassing, because it turns out I'm just not good enough.
Oh, no.
Well, that's the update done. See you later.
Amazing. Well, go and listen back if you can be asked, but if not, we'll chat about it. Anyway, the lovely Royal Britannia. Yay! Oh, Robbie Britton. How you doing?
I'm all right. Just apart from that kind of really depressing look back on my, where were you 5 years ago kind of thing, turns out I've just achieved nothing.
Hadn't you won a wheel of cheese or something at some point?
That. Well, we did win, between me, Sarah Tunstall and Ben Riddle, we won 13.5 kilos of cheese in one kind of meeting. I got 4.5, Sarah got 9 kilos of cheese, and Ben got like a quarter of a wheel for being third.
And so back then, I imagine that you thought, okay, well, this is the beginning. This is a start. 5 years on, did it turn out that that was the highlight?
That was, so like, if you look at the official ITRA rankings, that was one of my better runs, Trail de Valais. After that, I got injured. Long after that, I buggered, I think it was my knee, and I've had issues ever since. It actually goes back to that summer. There was a fall that I thought might have been why the knee issues started happening, but turns out, I've had some good ones, ups and downs. I've done some good things in the meantime, but I've also had a fair few injury woes and done some different bits and bobs. So yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that was the highlight. I've done at least one race that was considered particularly better. I've had some others that I personally enjoyed, and I've done some races where there was no one else competing, so you get to win anyway. Yay!
has that been like 4 years of just struggle, thinking I'm going to be back? Well, or how have you felt through that time? Because that is a really long time to be not running how you want to be running.
So I guess for a couple of those years, it was just like, there's a video of us running across Jordan, me and my mate Dan. And if you watch the video, I look like I'm in the final stage from day one. But I've just got this limp going on. It's kind of like I'm shuffling, dragging my right leg. And you don't see it yourself. I don't see it when I watch the video until I watched it like a year after I'd kind of really had to stop running and gone, wow, that is not the running gait of a healthy man. You look like, I look like I'm in pain, just running behind Dan, who's not himself. Like, you wouldn't use Dan as a poster boy for how to run. Like, I mean, he's a wonderful runner, but he's got his own style. And I'm behind him, I've trodden dog shit instantly and just kind of dragging my foot along. The last couple, it was a couple of summers ago, I had something that just stopped me running, an injury that stopped me running. And it's been 2 years of kind of trying to figure that out whilst also cycling to a reasonably large degree and potentially bringing in other issues from a badly fitted bike to like chasing niggles and injuries around. But I did. Obviously, it comes at a good time, right? This therapy session. I my first ultra in a couple of years, a few weekends back. So I am back in the game. I tried to time it with a book launch. I thought if I do a race, it was all right. I won, but I feel like that was one of the ones where the competition wasn't. All respect to the second and third place. Mm. They were 6 kilometres behind at the finish, and I had a bit of a mare, so I don't see it as my finest hour, but I won €150, so it's got, I mean, like, in terms of...
So that's going to be a regular...
€150!
Yeah.
Did you use that money to... Did you spend that money on cheese?
Yeah, I bought a massive wheel of cheese with it. It's just straight down the...
Presented it to yourself.
Then I went and bought pasta and pizza.
Because it's weird because I feel like we've stayed connected when we haven't, because I've always heard stories from Dan and from other people about kind of where you've been, what you've been up to. But what I found most fascinating is that someone told me that you've bought a house in Italy in a village where everyone's Italian as part of some kind of some scheme they're doing to try and generate energy in these villages where everyone's old and dying. Is there any truth to that? And if so, tell us about it.
Yeah, there's some truth. It feels like you've elaborated on it and maybe in like kind of put two and two together. There are towns in Italy where you can buy somewhere for €1 because the population's disappearing, and then you got a commitment to spend X, Y, and Z amount on to renovate this kind of hovel you've bought. Mm. We just found some with €5,000. Literally was the town's. It's the town that Fila, the sportswear company, was originally from. So the empty Fila factories are opposite us on the other side of the river.
Wow.
And we're in an apartment, and it was trying to sell it for 35, and then we saw the old, like the really depressing little signs, but they had like a for sale sign. It had the different prices. So it's gone down from 35 to 25 to 20, 17 to 10, and then we eventually bought it for 5. And the poor guy we bought it from, like, they're there in the meeting, and he has to pay 1,500 of that to the estate agents. He's getting €3,500, and he's had to drive from Milan to do the sales. He's probably cost him, I don't know, like £20 in petrol. Might have got a coffee on the way, 21, 20. So he's kind of everything he's doing on the way to sell this house is costing him money. And
he probably had to stay in like a hotel as well overnight. It was €200.
There are no hotels here, but yes, he slept in his car to save a few quid. But we just found, like, Natalie found it on a website, idealista.it. It's an Italian estate agents, and there's just loads of different little places of varying levels. It needed a new kitchen and a couple of windows replacing, but we just thought it was like a mistake at first. We said to the estate agent, like, you missed a zero or a one, like, from this number. He's like, no, he just needs to sell it because I think it's costing him money every year. I'm guessing it's where his parents lived, and he just kind of, they've passed away. And yeah, there used to be 2,000 people here. Now there's about 1,000.
And what's that like to, because I it's in the mountains, isn't it? So I mean, it must be amazing for trail, but what's it like to move to, because my understanding is you're not like fluent Italian.
Why'd you say this? How'd you say
this?
It's a big
assumption. Why would you do this to me, eh? I was going to respond, but I don't want to embarrass you, David. My Italian is mediocre. It's probably a little bit worse than my French, and my French isn't good. So you could, it's getting better. I feel like a large part of the Italian communication. And I was already a long way there in that regard. Like, I quite happily talk with my hands as much as possible. I'm doing it now, off the screen. And I do it on the phone. Like, I talk to people on the kind of hands-free thing, and I'm talking with my hands and explaining, like, a slope. So I'm there in that regard. And I haven't had any traditional... We had some... No traditional Italian lessons. So when we was in France, I had years of French at school. I did do Latin at school. Turns out... That language is not really kind of around anymore.
Well, the locals are old enough, aren't they? Some of them.
Yeah, we've got fluent in the old Latin. But no, I can read Italian right, getting there with the. I found as well, like, if you're not sure, you can add either an O to the end or azione, and like a lot of the words. You, like, I literally have. I go to my best teacher for Italian is the physio. I go to a couple of times a week. We go back and forth in English and Italian, and every now and again, my confidence grows, and I chuck in a word basically in English with azione on the end, and
I say physio.
Yeah. Oh, physiotherapy. It's easy, yeah. It's just an A or an O, and sometimes I get away with it, and I'm like, is that?
So is it a female physiotherapist in that situation?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's important to make sure that you get the masculine and the feminine right.
I'd still don't. That's one of the weird things, like learning any languages as an English. The masculine and feminine side of things just kind of gets a bit like, well, I don't know. And then you say the wrong one, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, why did you say that? I used to do the wrong one in France with wife, and used to tell people about my husband all the time.
When you move to like a little village, say something there's about 1,000 people, do they have any like weird traditions to welcome new people there? And I'm not saying like full Wicked
really good one.
Style thing or you know, is there a bit of a kind of a hoo ha and everyone sort of gathers around and watches you walk not, down the street and anything else like that?
It's still a town, right? So it's not like a tiny, tiny village.
Mm.
And so there's 1,000 people, 2,000, so there's a couple of factories either side of the river, and our side of the river is a hamlet, right? So it's pretty small. But the main kind of traditional thing they said to us when we arrived was just, why? Like, literally, you click on their face. Like, and you're like, oh, viva Masaranga. And they're like, okay. And you're like, what do you mean? You're like, what? Why? Why would you do this? And you're like, because it's beautiful. You're like, no, it's Masaranga. And to them, it's just this tiny little shitty little village at the end of a river valley that goes off to nowhere and has it's a dead end, and they're like, why would you move here? To us, it's this kind of beautiful little town with mountains that go on forever out the back. There's cycling, we're in a river valley, and either side is like a wonderful like cycling climb either side. Obviously, it was quite cheap. I explained that in Italian, and they're like, oh, that is pretty cheap, actually. and yeah, it's just beautiful, and the people are like friendly and really nice place to live, and Italy itself as a country is somewhere we've always enjoyed visiting, and then we were looking. The main thing they say is just why, and they just cannot understand. And then they go, what do you do for work? And I have to say that I'm a trust fund kid or something. I think that's what they think like we're somewhere. They can't tell that my accent isn't quite a public school. Oh yeah, you must be just a rich child that lives in the house. Like, no.
When they hear your accent, they're like, did you marry Madonna? Are you a famous film director? Because the reason I asked is because I'm currently with the Golden Trail. We're traveling with a lot of runners who are, they're coming to the realization that either they need to be somewhere with altitude or they want to be living near trails. And I think it's still quite common for people to move to like Chamonix, the mountains of Italy, because that's almost seen as a career step when it comes to moving into trail, into ultra, as being a requirement to getting really good for those types of races. Because have you found like a community, would you say? Has that been a struggle or?
But again, like look at it, you can look at it in two ways, right? You can look at it as a career step, right? If you honestly think people are making a living from running up and down mountains, and there's not many, there's a handful of people, right? Or you can look at it as a life step, right? And a way to improve your life is to live in an environment where you're close to the things you love, and you can focus on those things. So that's one of the things of Italy as well, is that there's a mountain culture, and the people around there. If you live in the mountains in the UK, there are people who enjoy the mountains there, but there are also people who just there's farmers and kind of the country. I think like the Lake District, right? There's a wonderful community of people in the Lake District that love the outdoors, and there's also the farmers who don't like people running across their fields, and there's like the people who've got second homes that have made it kind of all empty, whereas you come to any mountain town here and every single person in this village kind of gets it. If you want to go and run up and down a mountain, or you want to go to like the little old geezer who's just been living here all his life, you spot him on the way up the local mountain, and it's a lot more ingrained in the culture. But we've got a little team of runners from the local area that we're that we run with, and they're like, yeah, it was kind of met them. I met one of them through Strava. I sent him a message on Strava, and he didn't respond. So I took one of his little crowns, and then he didn't it was an effective way of communicating. And then, but there's like a couple of cyclists, and we're in a local cycling club. I accidentally joined like a senior citizens mountain biking club. So I am the youngest. I am easily half the age of the next youngest member, but they love it. But they're all very touchy-feely as well. So like if you do a race, I just get like loads of older gentlemen touching my muscles on my legs. My bike. Brilliant. I mean, if you're into that kind of thing, I highly recommend it. And even the neighbour, we moved in, and like they've moved out now, unfortunately. It means next door to Sal. But they... He runs marathons. He was like an older guy in his like early 60s, and you have a great chat with them, and they're kind of, they all think we're a bit strange, but I mean we get that wherever we live, wouldn't we?
And so you've done a lot of coaching then in the time, and how has that been? Like, have you been as natural at coaching as you thought you would be, and do you think the people looking for coaches, and also the actual known knowledge amongst like runners now is changing over those years?
That's like eight questions. What was you?
It is.
So since we last spoke, I did a master's in performance coaching with University of Stirling, which just took about 2.5 years. And that was extremely enlightening, really, really useful, and kind of helped not only kind of improve my own coaching, but kind of it gave us a guidance on where, how to keep continuing your journey and developing like an expertise in, or trying to develop an expertise in a certain area. And then after that, I've done a sports nutrition postgrad diploma over the last couple of years. I'm coming to the end of that. So I'd like to think my coach has improved. I've tried to improve the knowledge side of things. I've done more coaching. So like, how do you become a better coach? You do more coaching. It takes time. Mm-hmm. It takes building up experience, working with other athletes. And I think as a coach, I've gone maybe from I've said this a few times now, but I've gone from an athlete who coaches to support his athletic career to a coach who sometimes dabbles in a little bit of sport. It's definitely my profession. That's how it feels to me. I've forgotten the second half of your question now, but it's the knowledge of the athlete population, so much information out there, some athletes have got a really good grasp of what they should be doing, and some coaches have as well. None of us know everything. And each individual athlete you meet, there's new things to learn, because what works for one person doesn't necessarily work for another. You're starting afresh a little bit each time because you've got to learn what's right for this situation. But there's also still the sport's growing, and there's a huge amount of people who haven't got a fucking clue what they're doing. So there's always going to be some benefit to helping out like people. I mean, I'd say this like in the nicest possible way, but sometimes it's literally, have you tried eating to get through your ultra? Or maybe you should run faster, or just maybe not smash yourself in every single training run. This kind of advice still gets given out. And not saying the people I coach are pretty savvy. I normally check them for that beforehand. Do you normally eat during your ultras? Yeah, I like to eat. Cool. Right, let's start there. That's a good one. You're in.
I'd say... with Instagram these last few years, Instagram's almost empowered. It's given enough of a market to people that they've started at the point where, like, way before you would have become a coach, where they have followers and they've run a few races. But do you get a sense of other coaches, whether, because I love the fact that you've wanted to improve, that you've wanted to actually formalize within training and university courses what you're already, for some people, fairly expertise in. Do you think there needs to be more of that in coaching? And do you think we need to like protect runners a bit more from, not charlatans, but people who are fairly clueless?
I mean, the thing is, David, is that I was once that person with very little following. He'd done a couple of races. It was different back. I mean, like I'm talking 10 years ago. It's not that long ago, is it really? But I was once that person, and you could say like, oh yeah, we could protect people from these people that really don't have any clue what they're doing, but they got loads of followers and they're good at social media. Great. But or we could try and help those people that are good at social media and want to get into coaching and they have the right attitude. we could help them improve and therefore help the athletes. There's two ways of looking at it, right? See, I think there's as coaches, I try to, like, as, I have a group of coaches I try and work with, but like for Centurion, we've got a team of coaches, but also just a network of ultra running coaches that like become friends over the years, but just to try and help each other and help each other improve. And like, none of us, I don't think we really have many expert coaches in ultra running because we've not been doing it long enough. And there's so much more to still learn. So just like, we're all still learning. And I guess you're always trying to get better. And it's maybe we have to look at, like, where we were. I mean, obviously you guys, I bet there's plenty of podcasters that come out and you're thinking, you just got a load of followers. You haven't done the trial of fire like me and Jody. And but you could either burn them down so your podcast reigns supreme with your two listeners, or you can help those people make better podcasts. But I guess for you, it's slightly more business oriented. Like there's enough athletes to go around for all of us, so we might as well help the other coaches.
No, I mean, I'd say I guess the big difference with us is that Jody and I have never really claimed to be experts or, you know, to be...
I didn't claim to be an expert. What are you saying? I said, I'm
trying. No, true.
Well, we're not. We didn't set it up with an aim to get more business through our coaching, or, you know, which I think a lot of podcasts that
it's still not a business. I like
you are very still, good. I'll pass on one compliment per podcast. You are good at what you do. You get some good interviews. You're interesting and all that shit. Right, pass that along.
The way we do that, Robbie, though, is we make sure we don't get people on just talking about their books and stuff. That's how we
keep it fresh. We haven't mentioned a book yet. Come on.
Robbie, what is the title of your book? What is the title of it?
What is the title of it? 1001 Running Tips.
As soon as I heard that, I was like, this is bullshit. 1001. Like, how much not? Like, how? How big is this book?
Well, what you do is you get 8 tips and you just split them up into different words.
How did that happen? Like, when did it become 1001?
I actually sent over 1067 because I knew some of them were going to be shit and they were going to take them out. Makes sense, right? Some of them are duplicates because I was maybe lost in a frenzy of typing. Vertebrate Publishing asked me to. They've got so that Andy Kirkpatrick, who's a mountaineer and big wall climber that I really look up to, he has 1001 climbing tips, and they wanted to do one for running. And Andy Kirkpatrick's got a style. It's a bit more. It's a less traditional kind of. He's not writing a textbook. It is a really instructional book, the 1001 Climbing Tips, and they thought I might be a good person to, with my slightly different style and a touch of humour, to write a book that about with 1001 running tips. And they obviously know I'm full of useless tips that can bulk out a kind of book of that regard.
What number did you start to stretch?
I honestly came to the end and was like, oh, I really want to add a few more sections. I didn't find it. I mean, you guys have spoken to me before. I love talking. I love the sound of my own voice. I love telling people what to do and imparting knowledge. I honestly didn't find it a struggle at all. I had a big, you know, like on Blue Peter, that kind of thing, they filled up as you sent in, I don't know, dogs. I had one of them on the wall I made myself, and I just coloured it in as I went through and got to the top and was like, oh, I haven't done anything about this X, Y, and Z. Like, what's going on here?
So what would you say then of all of them that we'd read and be like, come on, is this really a tip? Like, wear trainers.
So I guess wear trainers until they're kippered was one of them. Don't just change everything. My goal was to kind of drag a few tips out and drop them in social media so people could share them far and wide. Actually, it doesn't. Not like those standalone tips that are just snappy and kind of lose their usefulness because they're actually just focused on being snappy and bold rather than actually useful. It flows. It's got like each tip is linked to the next one and it's almost so like a few of the people I know are reading sample copies so they can review it on Amazon. It's like, I guess it's a ploy. So you just pick people that like you, but again, it's not doesn't have to like me. They have to like the book, and they're reading it and they're saying like, and it's, I'm really looking forward to like the wider public actually getting to reading it a little bit and kind of giving feedback on it because it's exciting because it's something I've created.
Yeah.
But the They're saying it flows through. They are reading it from first page to last. It's not like you would expect the tips book. You open it on a certain page, you read a subject, yeah. And you're like, there's a handy. They're actually starting at the beginning, and it starts with like this, I put like 11, like rules, like the kind of interesting things that are a bit funny.
What's tip number one then?
The first 11, I'll get it up. The first 11 are like, these are some funny, like slightly funnier rules. But after that, it just starts at the beginning, like how to get into to running and then what you want to start doing. But tip number one, I'll get it up here. If I can find it. Here we go.
And
whatever pace you run and whatever surface you run on, if you want to call yourself a runner, then that's all that matters. Unless you're just walking, then you're a walker, but that's okay too.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And when you say it flows, does that mean that it almost starts at zero, assume knowledge, and introduces you to running and then blows you through to different distances, different surfaces, different style races? Or
we got basics is the first section with the rules, starting out where to run, goal setting and race choice, and then fell, trail, mounted, like what other types of running are. And then it's got a section on training, basics, training plans, do you need a coach? Effort levels, types of sessions, long runs, ultra long runs, chaos of periodization. And then it goes through like skills and techniques, environments, runner's body, which looks at stuff like the menstrual cycle and sleep deprivation and race food, racing, how to pre-race toilets, got its own section. that's sports psychology during 24-hour running, clothing, sustainability, covered everything, man.
Bivvying and camping. Social media use.
Pardon? Yeah. Self-promotion.
Yeah, social media is the last section.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, I put it in there. Blogging, because my background is more blogging than social media. And I feel like there's so many terrible, like, again, just 1,000 words. If you can't say it in 1,000 words, no one cares. Put it in 1,000 words. Right? And then, like, if you can't put it down to that, yeah, your mum's going to read it and say it's brilliant, right? But other people just haven't got the time to read 8,000 words about your... like your last section of your ultra where you had to walk every step. But like, there's no one needs 8,000 words on that. Like, just write 1,000. That's it. That's a good length. That's a tip. Yeah, and that's in there.
And would you feel like, did you go out to others to get additional tips, or were you?
Areas I spoke to people. Obviously, I spoke to some of the female athletes I work with. We're talking about the menstrual cycle and training, like racing on your period and stuff, because I've never done that. So there's certain things, if I was to write about it, like, it'd just be like, that geezer don't know what he's talking about. So it's areas like that. I checked through some of the other areas on training and physiology with my coach, Tom Craggs, because I really respect his opinion on and knowledge in that area. There are areas that, it's not ultra focused. So there's plenty of areas where I just wanted to get people to double check it. So yeah, there's certain bits like that. I spoke to Dan Lawson and Charlotte Jolly about the sustainability side of things, and just wanted to check with them that kind of stuff's not just talking a load of garbage. I should have checked. I think there is one about podcasting in there, because then I can search through, right? Podcasts. It might say no one needs any more podcasts.
Yeah. Why not just start a podcast with a mate? Just talk dribble to each other for an hour.
Downloading certain podcasts.
And there are some issues, some topics within running where people are quite polarized. So when it comes to things like barefoot running, carbs versus fat adaption, the Nike trainers, you know, all these types of things, do you address or talk about all aspects and give people options, or and how do you then approach it? Given there is conflict.
I'm going to give shit options, David, am I? Like, it's not going to be like you could either train in a periodized fashion using kind of carbohydrates and the science kind of, or you can listen to your mate on Twitter who loves eating just bananas and olive oil. I'd go with the science.
There are things like fat adaption and, you know, if you speak to...
wrong person.
There are studies that show lots of different things. And so if you speak to Noakes, for example, he would say actually that for longer races, fat adaption is the best thing to do, and to just completely cut carbs, and that you don't you don't necessarily even need them on race day.
Or you look at like Professor Louise Burke's work with the supernova studies, looking at race workers over the further amounts, and someone like Louise Burke has gone back and forth on the fat adaptation. Been very pro, she's been very against, and she come to like a more. Noakes is one of those people that almost chooses that polarized opinion to create controversy. I mean, his social media at the moment is fascinating, but also terribly dangerous. It feels like he's saying stuff to kind of get a reaction at times. Whereas you look at a more considered, I would definitely choose the people that you consider and to listen to in certain subjects like this. And definitely, I commend anyone who goes onto social media. I say it's easy to say this on a podcast. I'm not going to go on Twitter and take up the keto adapted debate, but Louise Burke does. And as a professor, she goes in there and actually says this stuff. But very simply, for performance, fat adaptation, if you're looking to your best performance, unless you have an intense carbohydrate sensitivity or there is a lack of carbohydrate availability in the race that you're doing, optimum performance, racing with carbohydrates is the most effective way. And then there's the only situation where I would consider it potentially would be that if you're in a wet area where, you get me off on a rant now, David.
I love it.
He tried to get you on a rant about social media and you didn't bite on that one. And so he's getting you on this one. He'll go through the list. Yeah.
I really recommend people constructing their own opinions, but just kind of questioning some of the studies out there that come. Learn how to pick apart and read through a study. If you don't want to do that, learn to kind of just anyone just says it's X or Y, right? If there's no kind of but, right, as I've just done then, then beware. So if you're in a situation where I've just done some ultra biking, like the bike packing stuff. And in that, right, there's situations in certain races, they have a race across, it's called the Silk Road Mountain Race. There's very, very long times between where you could get carbohydrates. So the amount of carbohydrates you have to carry would then potentially limit what you could, I'm not saying it definitely is. I don't think it is still. I still think it's more effective and there are drawbacks. But it might be worth looking into the fat adaptation side of things. Again, you're going to get into that situation probably just by being not having them available. But also, it limits your peak. So the supernova studies that they've done in the Australian Institute of Sport, they weren't able to respond to the moves in the races. So if you want to just do something, maybe there are situations in an ultra where you don't want to respond to any attacks or go up any hills. It's flat because again. Second you go up a hill and your intensity changes, you might not have the ability to use that. And what they found in those studies as well is that to improve your ability to utilize fat within your body, but does that relate to a performance improvement? You're changing the physiological thing. Why are we doing it? We're doing it for a performance improvement. And does it improve performance? And they found in those studies that no, it doesn't. Different situations, it may improve performance, but... And I'm not an expert. The postgrad I'm doing, the sports nutrition dietitian, you're supposed to. I got in there without a previous university degree in dietetics or nutrition, but I did come in there from an MSc in coaching and had some knowledge, and they let me in there, and I've very much enjoyed it. I feel like at times I was my knowledge has definitely got big gaps in it whereas someone who come from the more traditional sense, but in other areas where it's mostly related to what I do. For performance, nah, mate. So on the polarizing subjects like that, I do give, there's definitely sections on, I got told to remove Don't Listen to @KetoDave social media, because it turns out that was a real person. And I just thought, it was like,
that's my pseudonym. That's my,
yeah, is that what you're going on about?
It's where I sell all my supplements.
Low carb, high fat, if I type that in.
And things like, because barefoot running or not, because if someone's never run before, that you could potentially suggest, or someone's talking about children and running, or that different shoe styles might be beneficial.
I guess this tip here, I've typed in keto and it's come up number 405. Anyone who suggests that their diet, plant-based or banana only, keto plant-based or banana only diet is the answer to all humankind's woes. Should be viewed skeptically. Watch out for one size fits all solutions. People that write in capital letters on social media about their diet. That's it. I mean, it goes for anything, man. But there's definitely situations where running without your shoes on is beneficial. But if you only run without your shoes on and there's a section of your race that's got glass on the floor, then that's a shit idea.
What about poos?
What about the controversial area of caffeine? Do you mention that? David will take a keen interest in your thoughts on that.
Yeah.
Caffeine Dave. Anyone that suggests a caffeine Dave.
I refer to caffeine as a wonderful friend of ours.
Thank you, Robbie. Thank you.
Leave it at that. I don't give it all away. I talk about it in the terms of...
I mean, you're not gonna say your 1,000 on this potty. There's no worry that how long. I know they go long at times, but we're not gonna go that long.
Giving them all away.
Are you gonna do an audio version?
I don't know. I've not been asked to. Maybe they're getting something like Stephen Fry to do it, so it sounds better. Then we're like some Cockney. Don't have any bananas before you go out on your long run. I mean, you can have bananas when you go long run. That's just the first thing that comes to mind. You could do it in like the voice of the craze or something.
And what would you say then from the areas that you had to actually bring in other experts? What were the things that were different to expected or you thought were most useful from that you learned while writing it?
A lot of it I wrote from my own knowledge. So, and that sounds big-headed, but no, I wrote about areas that I knew about. So I didn't go, it wasn't like a lot of research into different areas. It was sufficient areas that I could write about. Different areas, like I was writing about altitude training and Chris Howe at Kingston Uni, he helped with just kind of just rewording it sometimes. Sometimes you make stuff and you're writing and you're kind of in the flow of it and you just want to make sure it's correct. Wording's correct and actually it couldn't be misinterpreted in terms of like stuff about sleep and it was more a rehashing of stuff I already know. And to try and put that down on paper, I was making sure that it was correct. I didn't go out of my way to research very in-depth subjects I didn't know about because it wasn't that type of book. It was my 1001 tips. So, there was some bits about making trail running more accessible to females that I was chatting through with Sophie when she helped with that regard. I wasn't trying to write about a different sport altogether. It was trying to jump on the knowledge that was already there and experience.
What's the one bit of advice that you give in there that you routinely don't do yourself?
So recently I've had a cold it's coming up to 3 weeks now and it came in a period between two races, one running, one biking, and I didn't rest as much as I should have done. So maybe like the rest days, restfulness of running is probably the one I don't adhere to as much myself, but I'm not bad. So it's
And which are there any that you think you might? Which ones will be called up, and which ones are more likely for people to contest or call out?
Oh, contest? Yeah, well, I guess you'd be the ones around diet and stuff because people. Mm. But I've tried to write in a way that it's literally like. As you said, if you've only got one worldview and that's your one thing, then maybe just be a bit sceptical. But those are the kind of people that don't do keto. And I haven't written that, but that's what they'll see in the words I've written. Maybe there are definitely situations. I mean, there's stuff around like people with diabetes and the keto diet being really beneficial. I believe there is some research around that. I try to write stuff just backed by science, by evidence, right? A lot of it isn't. There are bits where it's not. It's kind of me making suggestions around sleep deprivation from experience. I'm quite opinionated. I'm not against learning and having a good old discussion with someone. But you can, after a while, like some, again, you bring up notes like drink to first and stuff. I've had a discussion. I wouldn't even call it a discussion, just like a boring waste of time going back and forth with someone that really just is. He might listen to this now, but it just wasn't ever going to go anywhere. I was willing to kind of learn, But like drink to first is a really good example. In some situations, for some people, drink to first is an appropriate way to manage your race. If you take that same person and chuck them in the desert, the idea being that your first mechanism will adapt and make you drink enough. It just wouldn't. If you put 100 people in the desert at 40 degrees and told them to drink the first, some of them would die, right? Even if they had the right amount of water. So I don't see what's wrong with kind of making a plan that maybe takes in your experience of drinking the first, but also has a bit of a structure to it. Because I think drink the first works when we're sat here, you and I, the three of us sat here. If we're thirsty, we're going to drink before we get dehydrated. You're very unlikely to sit in your kitchen and desiccate. Is that the word? Or is that defecate's a different one? Don't do that either in your kitchen. But like, you're not just going to become a prune, right? Because you drink because you're thirsty. But when you go into more of an extreme situation, and that running is a more extreme situation than sitting, right? You're going beyond your body's usual kind of coping strategy for first. And they point to loads of the studies that drink to first around marathons. Basically, you're not running a marathon long enough to do yourself enough damage in terms of dehydration, right?
But what do you say then? Because actually going in, the one area where there's, because a lot of the miscommunication is from brands and from nutrition companies. What are you saying about electrolytes? Because that seems to be, the first studies of Noakes, it was Gatorade, were the people who were just forcing it down. You need your electrolytes. You need your drinks. What would you say for electrolytes then?
So I've worked with Precision Hydration for quite a few years now. So that's probably a disclaimer to add before I even discuss this. I do disagree with a couple of things they say as well. But I think it's worth investigating what level of electrolytes you need. Because it varies for all of us. We're all very individual. And if we just start to kind of say that's not necessary, why not? Like, why would you not? If I've got runners who sweat at a rate of about around 500 milligrams a litre of sweat of sodium, and sodium's the main impactor here, right? So I'll talk about, and I've got runners over 2000 milligrams of sodium per litre of sweat. So why, if those two runners are sweating 10 litres of sweat in a race, why would you not use that information? Why would you not be more precise with your hydration? See what I did there. But like, so I just think, why not? Like, why would you not try and figure it out if there is something to figure out? Or you can just kind of, if you're having stomach issues and you're having issues around, the biggest one is when people just kind of, like hypo and hyponatremia, the symptoms are very similar, right? And you get fatigue and nausea and things like that. And then you get that liquid in your stomach that's sitting there. People are like, if you're drinking to first and not paying any attention to your electrolytes, and that's happening, I'm like thinking about, no. Got to drink to first. Eventually your body will figure it out. No, it won't. So why not use the information we have and use a bit of science? So that's my opinion. So again, it varies. I've had runners, we had a runner on a training camp, and he was like, the general idea is you need more electrolytes, mate. You need more. Yeah. And that's what Gatorade and the light are pumping out. And again, it's not that simple. It varies. Yeah. The three of us here, I know mine's pretty middle of the road, 1,000 milligrams a litre. So I try and match what's going in to what's coming out. So I'm not in much of a deficit. I don't always get it right. It's not easy to do the longer you go. And there are other bits and bobs involved in the environment and just like poor decision making. But I make an effort. And then we had one runner, and I was watching him, and he was like, yeah, I just get all the symptoms after about 30 miles into every race I do. And I'm taking that, these drinks, these electrolyte tabs, these. And I was like, right. Maybe you need less. So this is like, and he was a really heavy sweater. So again, your heavy sweater, you're thinking, oh, I need to take on like loads of salt because I'm sweating loads, so I must be losing something. I took one for the team here, and I licked his arm, and it was not salty whatsoever. It was just really kind of non-salty sweat. And I was like, mate, maybe you because you sweat so much, your body's adapted in a way that it doesn't want to piss out all this salt, because it's like, whoa, this is like basically a leaky tap. We've got to stop. I don't know if it's how the body works. So again, this is where my area.
He's like his own mobile aid station, isn't he?
Yeah, he's just a drink just for everyone else. And like we use our dog Rosa. She's very good. Like if you can't get to a Precision Hydration testing center, I highly recommend having a dog like a German Shepherd pointer. And then after a run, if you put yourself in a group, the level of intent, they lick your legs. That's how salty you are. So if they come to your legs. Man, this man's rubbish. They just, and it's worked, right? I've done it with people that I know this. And And Rose is like, yeah, you're rubbish, I'm not licking you. And then she goes to my leg and it's like you've just handed her a bowl of heroin. And she's like, oh, loves it. So again, it's like, you don't have to be super scientific. You don't you can use your intuition with this stuff. And you can just be, it's not any kind of area like that. It's just using, I don't want to use the word common sense, but just being inquisitive and not taking what anyone says, even myself, as gospel. Question it. Question everything you hear. Well, too much, I think, bullshit on the social media things these days, where people just come out with whatever they want because they know that half the people believe them, half of them will say that's a load of rubbish, and they'll get more followers.
But I think a lot of the reasons why people aren't more intuitive is because they don't give them the space or the time when they're suddenly doing a new race. It's just, right, I'm running 100 mile an hour. I've never run one. I'm doing it in 4 months. And so they don't have the practice time. They don't go out and actually have that opportunity to have listened to their body to then try and figure things out. They're almost having to make those shortcuts because they're ambitious. And
especially with hydration and you talk about electrolytes, because, and again, over a marathon, you're not causing enough issues for it to be a problem. And a lot of the studies, like major studies around marathon and dehydration. So it has dehydration affected your race? No, it hasn't. Well, you're at 6% dehydrated. Wow, that's amazing. Like, it hasn't changed my time whatsoever. Yeah, because if you'd have then carried on for 50 miles, then you would have been in bits. And gotten on that one, and I've gone off on, I can't remember what I was going to say. Yeah, and it's hard to kind of, if you're doing a longer race, by the time it's a problem, it might be you're getting it 20% wrong each hour. So say every litre you drink, I know I'm going to use simple math, you're 1,000 milligrams a litre, right? And you're trying to have a litre an hour, which is a lot, you'd be weeing lots. So that doesn't work as too much, but it's easier for maths. And every hour you're having 500 milligrams instead of 1,000, right? By 5 hours, you're out by 2,500 milligrams. By 10 hours, 5,000 milligrams out. By 15 hours, you get the feeling, right? So it's not a problem at 5. It's barely a problem at 10. At 15, it's so debilitating that your race is over. And how do we practice that without running for 15 hours? You could experiment in certain ways by kind of exaggerating it, and that could get dangerous. You just got to kind of think about past experiences and you can look at salt on your clothes and stuff, but even that, like if you have a low sodium rate in your sweat and you sweat loads, you might get salt in your clothes. If you have a low sweat rate but high sodium, you might get salt in your clothes. So it's all different kind of, you can't tell even just from that. So it is just questioning it and trying different things, trial and error, listening to people that might help, but just taking all of it with a pinch of salt. Look at that.
Now the nice, I like that. Now, most important for the book and the marketing, what is the picture? Is it you going, hey?
Of me, of what? What picture? Like
on the front of the book.
Front of the book, it's a cartoon, a drawing. It's a really nice look. Can I share the screen?
Yeah. For our YouTube viewers.
Any
episodes.
I can't find, I've just got the book. I've got the pages inside. I haven't got the cover. You can get the cover. It's a really nice, colourful, pink, yellow kind of got a picture of some people running. We did look at have some pictures on the front, but it just felt better when they said, these are the pictures we've got. And it's all coloured in really nicely. That would just, it just works so much better. And it looks nice.
It might be a bit late now, but my suggestion would have been that one of those tips was to buy another copy of the book for a friend. instantly double sales.
I did consider that. It does at the end. So runners, what I've done at the end, the further so
runners world are happy to do that all the time in their lists, all the time.
That's just an easy tip, though, isn't it? So, at the end, there's further reading, right? And I've recommended my friend's book, and I haven't read his book. I have read his book. Hopefully, in his book, it says how great it does. I mentioned in there, so then they'll read that, and it's kind of a cyclical kind of. They just keep buying the same book again and again.
No one reads the further reading bit. Like, you only people put it in there just so you can lose.
I'm regretting putting you guys in there now, then.
Everyone knows what that's what the further reading's for.
So I'm trying something. I'm going live on Instagram. I've no idea whether this will work. But
why?
For people to ask questions. Because we didn't have enough time to ask in advance. So if anyone's got a question for...
I tell you what, There is nothing more frightening than David taking over the Instagram account. When he's had a few drinks and all of a sudden I see he's got the Instagram account and he's in charge of it. It's just, it's the most worrying thing. What's going to end up on live video? How's he going to libel someone? Unbelievable.
Especially because I still don't really understand how live works or anything.
I don't understand the concept of live.
And the concept of libel as well. I guess that's probably. I'm also one for that as well. I'm not very good at.
Well, I suppose actually, just for you can't really libel someone in the spoken form. That's slander, of course. I mean, of course, libel in written form.
Someone's eating hip slopping on this.
Look at that. Well, I might have done that anyway. We're talking about my book, really, aren't we?
Oh, I've forgotten. There is a problem with this, and that's that I've got my headphones in. No one can hear anything. Maybe not. So what are your plans then for the? Where do you see your racing going then in the future? Have you still got intentions of coming back and getting into any particular distances?
Give up, mate. Just give up. Like if at first it's too difficult, just give up and then I'm gonna win everything. Still have the same intentions I had 5 years ago. Whatever when I spoke to you last, I'd be less than five. It'd have been 20 years. 4 years ago. I've improved in different ways. Definitely, even when I'm injured, I've been on the bike doing these bikepacking races, and it's really kind of, if you want to go to some deep, dark, wonderful places, well, miserable, I recommend cycling for like 40 hours straight and just crying your eyes out. It's really good. You can get to those dark and horrible places without the damage you do yourself whilst running. Like if you run for 40 hours, you're broken, right? Your muscles are everything sore, feet are fucked, you're mumped off. You do it on a bike, just a bit tired, and you can really play around with sleep deprivation in a way that you can't too often as a runner. So I've been working on my sleep deprivation in the last 2 years, and that's been fun.
What have you learned from that then? What has worked for you?
That's one of the areas of the book that actually has been something I've learned in the last few years. There's a thing called adenosine that builds up in our brain. And the breakdown of adenosine triphosphate, I believe. And that kind of, it makes us tired, right? I mean, when it fills up, I look, again, this is where it's become simpler in my mind. It's like a glass, right? And it fills up. When it gets to the top, that's when you're like just falling asleep on the handlebars or like just can't stay awake. And the only way to deplete that is to actually sleep. So if we have caffeine, which you are a dealer of, that fuzzes the receptors. It kind of blurs them, but it doesn't actually deplete. So you can have caffeine, and each time if you kept just topping up the caffeine, you're not actually emptying out the kind of tank full of junk that you need to empty. So then one of the things that I've tried is microsleeps, where you're doing, I had 2 times 2 minute sleeps, but 4 minutes or 5 minutes of a sleep. And the timing's important because you're doing it when you're absolutely kippered and you're dead on your feet. Have a 4 or 5 minute sleep, and then you're good again because you depleted enough. And again, if you're working, if metabolic demand outweighs metabolic supply, it builds up quicker. Basically, if you're working too hard or not eating enough, you're going to get more tired quickly. So some of the longer stuff, especially if you're racing the UTMB or the Lavaredo or the West Highland Way, where you're starting into night, you're starting sleep deprived, the more you're above your kind of, you're working above the level you should be, the more tired you're going to get as well. So the sleep deprivation is going to come in. So if you know you suffer with the sleep side of things in ultras, pull it back a notch, focus on eating consistently throughout the night, and it should build up to a lesser extent. And this does work. One of my athletes just won a bike race of 1180 kilometers. And that's one of the things we've been working on to make him stay on the bike. It was like 60 hours or 55 hours he might have been, and he slept for 40 minutes and couple extra micro sleeps. That's one of the things we've been working on, was kind of, and it was all part of like just going a bit easier, make sure he keeps eating and stay on that bike. He out cycled everyone.
And have they ever done any studies on how quickly that depletion occurs? Like, is there a marked difference? You're talking about micro sleeps, but between like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes, 20 minutes, 40 minutes.
I don't know.
Because
I guess how would you, that, I don't know, they have to, I'll have to look into that. I have, Yeah, that would be a good. That's a good question to ask, because that should be something that. Because I remember, so when I first started looking into this stuff, obviously it's not much in regard to bike packing or ultra running, but I thought there should be a lot more information around sleep deprivation. I remember there was, I think it's Shona Howson, who's a podcast of hers. She's an expert in the sleep deprivation kind of stuff. And I was 46 hours into a bike race where I'd had a 90-minute sleep in the middle. And I was listening to the podcast in one ear, because you don't want to die, right? And she was saying that we're not going to talk about acute sleep deprivation, because it doesn't really come into sports performance. And I was thinking, well, I am right now. What's this about? And then it was like, but they talk more. So the more the research is on chronic sleep deprivation, so because no one generally, in terms of sport, they don't not sleep for 40 hours, right? What other sports that actually warrant a lot of research involve not sleeping for 40 hours? But again, you've got like military stuff probably, and that would be worth looking. I'm sure there's stuff around there. But also it's kind of like if an athlete who's in a team sport, is what they were looking at, is missing their sleep night after night and they're only getting 4 hours instead of six, what impact does that have on? And it affects concentration, it affects like the memory side of things, it affects your perception of effort. And that's one of the biggest things of sleep deprivation, is it affects your perception of effort. So actually the day after, like when you're knackered and you're like, you can't go as fast as you want to, a major part of that isn't that you're physiologically less capable, it's just that your whole perception of how hard everything is completely warped by the sleep deprivation. So
do you feel like you're absolutely ragging it, but you're just doing a mild jog?
Yeah. And there's loads of stuff there, and you come back to notes with your central governor and like Samuel McCorah, who's and then there some of their Twitter spats and stuff. Different, like watching academics argue on Twitter is brilliant, because it's just they can get really nasty. It's quite funny. But his stuff is all around perception of effort, and the idea being like that if you had how that your perception of effort impacts actually how hard it is for you. And the example I often use, if you've got two runners at mile 20 of the marathon and they're genetic clones, they've trained the same, they've paced the same, and the whole like their whole race is identical up to this moment, but runner A is and they're both running 6 minute miles, but runner A is being overtaken by people and runner B is overtaking people, one of those runners is going to be having an easier time. You know, it would literally physically feel easier to be the person overtaking. So how can we use that in our
own racing? We had something, I guess, kind of similar with what, I can't remember the journal, Alex Hutchinson, I think, or okay, someone.
Yeah. He'd
been saying he'd been trying to break 4 minutes for a mile for years and years and years. And actually it was only once one of the people on the bell was calling it wrong and he was called 10 seconds ahead of where he thought he was, that suddenly he actually then, or it was 10, it was 10 yards off the right place.
It was 59 meters, wasn't it? In his book, the first chapter. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And then
he was going faster than he was, and actually it felt easy. So he was, it kind of changed his perception of how all of that effort and all of the effort after the race. And it was a massive breakthrough for him, wasn't it? And he got onto the Canadian running team around that time, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then every run after that, even though he knew the previous one was because of this cause, it was absolutely fine to break four because he'd done it. He had that confidence. Interesting. And with these longer races, because my real fear would be when you're running, I mean, we know of people who've been doing these crazy long runs who have fallen over running and you know, smashed their face up, had injuries. On a bike, though, that's obviously really, really risky. Like, where do these races happen? Are they on main roads? Or
yeah, it's a whole mix of them. One of the more famous ones, the Transcontinental, which is from one side of, goes from like Brest to Istanbul. They cross the continent of Europe. And those have set routes, and the athletes will choose their own route between the set checkpoints. Sorry, they have set checkpoints, and you choose your own routes. And invariably, because it's a race, you end up choosing to go on faster roads and more busy roads. And some of them are set routes. So I did one a couple of years ago in the summer, or last summer. There was the Three Peaks bike race that was 2,000 kilometers, and it had checkpoints, three mountains, and you chose your own route between. And I found myself horrible roads because I was like, well, this is the fastest way, and I'm racing. And it, you kind of then think, well, actually, like the additional stress of that is not worth it. Can't eat. I'm not, my hand is not great, so I'm not eating a banana whilst there's a HGV behind me. So then it's inherently more dangerous cycling a bicycle while sleep deprived. Definitely. I've had this discussion with others cyclists when they talk about, well, actually, if you look at the miles done per cyclist in the transcontinental over the years, it's less dangerous than cycling around London. Doesn't mean it's not dangerous. And there are deaths. Mike Hall was the guy who invented that transcontinental race. He died in a race in Australia, and his memory is huge within the sport. And I never got to meet or know the man, but you feel like you know a lot about him because it's the impact's there. And it's a terrible loss. And there was a lady in Hungary during a race this year who was, the bike was rear-ended. So again, like, she was cycling at night. You're all lit up. There are rules and stuff, but all I saw was a picture of the bike, and the back wheel had just been crushed in. And then you start wondering, okay, well, yeah, so maybe you were sleep deprived, and maybe, and I'm not saying this situation because I don't know anything about it. If I was a cyclist and someone hit me from behind, the first thing I might think would be, did I weave over? What's more likely, though, cyclists weaving a bit, or a driver on their phone, or driver pissed, or driver not looking? So again,
even if the cyclist is weaving, the driver should be looking.
Yeah,
and that shouldn't be an issue. So then, what would you recommend? Oh, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead, Robbie.
No, I did have it on a mountainside once where I was quite a drop, and it was the final of that. I had about 6 hours sleep in 5 days, and I was talking to myself to make sure I stayed awake because there was a drop off on this mountain road, and I was near the finish, so I was kind of pushing through. I hadn't eaten, and I'd run out of food, and I was in France, so there was just nothing open. And I remember answering a question about Leicester Football Club, but I couldn't remember the question. And given that I was speaking to myself, I figured that was maybe a moment to stop and give myself some slaps and stuff. And then a little bit further down that road, I actually had a boar run out from the side of the trail. It absolutely I screamed boar repeatedly at the boar in case it was struggling with like self-identification. And the adrenaline after that, I was fully awake after that. So if you are really sleep deprived, I really recommend like accidentally cycling next to a boar for 3 or 4 seconds. Weird hallucinations as well. Like, I've not had them in running. I've never had the sleep deprivation kind of, but I like the tricks of the light. I remember cycling into I had a really nice deja vu. I didn't know what was coming. The second I got around the corner, I knew I'd been there before. And it was fascinating because apparently it's to do with your brain getting confused and storing everything you see in your long-term memory rather than your short-term memory. So you look at something and you're like, I've been here before, because it's in your long-term memory. And then you get around the next bend, you're like, well, what's around the next bend? I don't know, but I've been here before. And you get around the next bend, you go, oh yeah, it was that bus stop. Yeah, yeah, I remember that.
Gone back on that course? Like, to see whether how you then do the course is as if you've known it for years, or
I got absolutely no recall of that. Like, even I'd struggle to find the place on the map. And yeah, I remember chatting to Nats after, and I said, "Yeah, I've been there before," and I started inventing stories to go with it. Like, yeah, I was there with Rye, and I'm like, never cycled with Rye, so how was I cycling up that road with Rye? It even got even worse. So it was really. Yeah, but I'd done a long distance run with my mate Rye, and that's where I guess the memories were getting crossed over. But I remember cycling into a town, and I was like, really cool that they've sculpted the faces into all these rocks. It must have taken them so much. They're not there, are they? They're just rocks. It's just, and I thought everything had like faces sculpted into it, and it was quite fascinating to be in that situation to kind of. And it just like that was as the daylight was going, I was getting to a point where I should have had some more sleep because the finish line was only 50k away, which only took me another like 3 hours in the dark.
So you're basically saying if a long distance cyclist witnesses a murder, we probably shouldn't use their statement as evidence in court, because it could be it could tell all kind of tales that are not true.
I don't know. Would you use a drunk person's statement in court?
Ooh. I think you probably wouldn't. You probably wouldn't as much. I think you'd have more.
It would limit it. But I guess as well, I've had some very clear thoughts on day seven. I have memories of sitting in 44 degrees of heat, eating cream buns on the side of Mont Ventoux. I know that memory will just stay with me forever. And I was extremely sleep deprived at that time. That boar, I will always remember it.
If it ever existed.
Because I can see the spike in heart rate on the on the
trail. One other tip that probably won't help you if you're in a race, but if you hold your breath for long enough, it will help wake you up. You force a breath down. Yeah. Because
hold your breath for long enough. I'll try that.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously, if you're cycling, you might need your breath more than you need your... Well,
downhill, mate.
Is that with scuba diving?
Yeah, true. Yeah, with scuba. Or hyperventilate when you're scuba diving.
I reckon that could work on a downhill. That's when I feel most tired, because you're just more bored. You're just like...
Yeah.
Whee!
And have you had any approaches, any tactics for when you are that tired for... trying to snap yourself out of it?
You have a sleep for like 4 minutes.
4 minutes.
It worked. I remember like a couple of times I've done it in races, and did one race and it was 33 hours and I had a 4 minute sleep and I was like dead on my feet. I had that 4 minute sleep and I cycled to the finish and I didn't feel tired again till that night.
And if you double that with caffeine, the caffeine will kick in while you're sleeping and you'll wake up actually more alert than if you'd had just caffeine or just sleep.
I wondered why you were banging on about down with sleep deprivation. I was wondering, why are you going down this route? Oh, you had to slip caffeine in there. Unbelievable.
I would say actually that caffeine bullet's probably not the best product for that situation, because you it's better to have something that you swallow rather than you chew, because if you're chewing it, you're going to be absorbing the caffeine, and by the time you get to your sleep, the caffeine will start to kick. It might not work with caffeine bullet as well.
Here we go. David, I've got it. With any 20 to 30 minute power nap, it's worth taking on some fuel and caffeine beforehand. The caffeine takes about 20 minutes to kick in. That way you'll wake up ready to take on the world, or just chatting a lot more rubbish than usual. Either way, it'll keep you awake for the next few hours. Try health.
See, that's only true if it's caffeine that isn't absorbed through your mouth. So like that won't work for Revies or for caffeine bullet or for caffeine gum. But you want to swallow it just because the absorption process happens while you're masticating. So actually the caffeine will be going directly into your bloodstream. So it might be that it will stop you getting sleep in the first place.
How quickly does that happen when you're chewing it?
Within five to 10 to 15 minutes is the peak that it hits the peak, whereas it would normally take at least 25 minutes to half an hour to peak in the bloodstream. Yeah.
But I'm talking about 4 minute sleeps, man. So obviously you can chew and have a 4 minute sleep, right?
Yeah, you could. Well, so do bag caffeine bullet is Robbie's point, which is very well made, Robbie. Very well made. Well, talking about
don't chew gum whilst you're falling asleep. Surely that's dangerous, right?
That's true, especially not bubble gum.
Yeah. How was it? Yeah, he slept beautifully for the rest of his time on Earth because he died. ultra cycling is dangerous, isn't it? How did he die? He choked on a caffeine bullet.
What a way to go! Doing an extreme event and actually you choked on a caffeine bullet. That would have. You'd say you wouldn't even mention that in the eulogy.
You'd just say by the bullet. Died by the bullet. Just to get some credibility back. So when does this book come out, and what's the best way for you to make money? Where should they buy it from when they're buying?
Best way for me to make money? Just send it in a big box to me and Italy, buy me another apartment. So it's available for pre-order now. It's on Vertebrate Publishing's website. You can pre-order it on there. And I think we agreed on the first 200 to get an extra tip. I've been writing these. I've been just like personalizing different tips, trying to do as much. I'm doing a little bit of research. This one here is actually my uncle who bought it, and I just told him to buy a heater for his workshop because it's cold. He doesn't run. So what use is another running tip when he just bought 1,001 running tips because his nephew's written it? But like,
you're going to go on people's Instagram and have a look, see who's bought it, and go, you might want to lose.
I've got the list. I'm using Power of 10 and DUV to kind of do a look. I haven't got an Instagram. That's a bit too creepy, mate. Blimey. But yeah, some of them, like, I just, yeah, there you go. Hey, David, this is not you, David. There's no prize for being the 100th person to order my book except this postcard. But it's all good to have numerical targets. Aiming to give 100% on race day is better than focusing on others. And that's, he's the 100th person to buy my book. He gets an extra tip.
I like that.
That's good. That's really good.
So hopefully not too many people order the book because this is fucking taking ages.
And it's
but yes, if you buy it through Vertebrate, there is a chance you'll get one of those postcards.
And if you pre-buy it, it's £20 rather than £25 for paper.
There you go. And you get it on, like, I've seen it on the Waterstones website and WH Smith, which is me as a youth who spent hours and hours in both of those stores. It was quite nice to see it. I'd get a £5 a month token from my nan, who's a massive inspiration for me for writing. I'd spend hours in there trying to find out how I could get the most books for a fiver, which nowadays, zero books for a fiver. But pre-inflation or whatever, I don't know, it wasn't for decimalisation. You could get a decent, you could get maybe like a buy one, get one free. If you saved that 2 months' worth, and I'll just read the books in there. So it's nice. You can get them in hopefully in actual bookshops. Go in a bookshop and pick up, and then people will be like, oh, there's one or two of these tips are okay, and then they find themselves hours lost of their life by the book.
And if people want to contact you about coaching in the future, what's the best way for them to do that?
They go on the Centurion Running Coaching section. I don't have any new space for one-to-one athletes. I've got a nice enough bunch of people, and there's only so many people you can coach about it taking too much time. But we've got a team of coaches there that I help and work with, and we've also got group coaching opportunity where people, it's a little bit cheaper and you can be part of the training. It's called the Training Plan Plus because it's not, people wanted a training plan, and I'm not a fan. Like, even in the book, it says if you get a training plan, great, but this is the tools you need. These are the tools you can use to make that training plan work for you. I think as soon as you get an off the shelf plan, it's either not written for you in the first place, or if it is, by the time you've had a week of work, life and shit yourself on your intervals, that plan needs to change. So Training Plan Plus is that we've got a group, we give them a plan monthly and we try and educate them to work together. I mean, you got the best part of that is that they, not only do you help them change the plan themselves, there's a group of people who learn together and support each other. So it's a really nice, so that's the two ways for the coaching, Training Plan Plus or coming on Centurion and working one of the coaches, like Sophie Grant, Sarah Cameron, Eddie Sutton, Neil Bryant, Tom Craggs, Rye Webb. They're the coaches I work with at Centurion.
Amazing. Well, good luck with the book launch. And thank you so much for coming on and telling a lot of the tips. But there's still a lot of tips left out there. So a perfect Christmas present, shall we add?
I reckon for a runner or even a non-runner, because there are tips that apply to life in there.
Well, good luck with the launch and good luck with future races. I'm sure we'll get you back on in the future at some point.
Try and win a race, and then we can talk about my running rather than my writing or my cycling. That'd be nice.
We're happy to have you on for either. And best of luck with everything between now and then.
Thanks for having me on.
Cheers, Robbie. Take care.
See you later.
And give me one more try, 'cause a love like this should I never ever die. Come back.
Fuck you, buddy.